No, I want you. I want you to have it.
Here's an issue that will inevitably arise when you're making a defense on the biblical ethic of the sanctity of life. We will be criticized frequently by opponents who say, well, why are you so passionate and dogmatic in your affirmation, you know, that it's wrong to take life because life has this inherent value, and yet you'll support capital punishment, or you'll support the military, and you'll support those forms that of taking of life. And so we're trying to be careful to make a distinction. You may have some loved ones who are in the military. There may be people in this assembly who have killed human beings. Or you may have loved ones who have killed human beings or are killing human beings now. We're not saying that it's always wrong to take life. What I've been trying to stress, and I've tried to use language that makes this distinction, is we're talking about the taking of innocent human life without just cause. Both of those phrases are important. Innocent human life without just cause. It's conceivable even in some situations where you would have ethical grounds to take even innocent life. But we're saying that you can't take innocent life without just cause, and so that's why we're saying you can't simply dispose of life because it's inconvenient. We're not saying it's always wrong to take life. In fact, the punishment for the unjust taking of innocent life is itself a forfeiture of your own life. The Bible teaches you can forfeit your right to life. But in observing that punishment for murder, capital punishment, you're actually upholding the dignity and value of human life, of the life of the victim and of the perpetrator, in that you're holding him responsible as a human being, accountable for his actions. So let's not allow people to confuse the issue. We're not suggesting that it's always wrong to take life. So that distinction will be important, I think.
Let me just say one word about the importance of dealing with issues such as this. I realize that when we talk about gospel preaching, we think oftentimes about preaching the plan of salvation and the organization of the church and the worship of the church, and certainly all those things ought to be preached and preached regularly by gospel preachers. But I have noticed some brethren across the years when I've preached on issues such as this who almost act as if we have not really done any gospel preaching on that particular day. In fact, one lady, after I preached about some issues related to the Terry Schiavo case, I told the elders, she said, it seemed like we were watching the news today. Well, I don't really think she listened all that well, because I was bringing passages in that dealt with the things we were discussing. And the issue of whether human life is significant is a matter of biblical teaching. And so to take time in the pulpit or in a classroom or in a bulletin article to teach on such is a matter that pertains to life and godliness, right? And all things that pertain to life and godliness have been given to us by God. And therefore, it's not a waste of time. It is not a, in any way, shape, or form, a political speech to give what the moral issues of the Bible are. And, you know, just because politicians have taken it upon themselves to presume to start tampering and dabbling in the field of morality doesn't mean that suddenly my hands are tied behind my back to say anything about it just because they happen to introduce it. If God put it in the Bible and it's a moral issue, then whether it's a Republican, Democrat, or anyone in between, an independent, if they're speaking on some moral issue, I have every right as a gospel preacher to teach what the Bible teaches about that subject. And that's very important for us to keep in mind. And, you know, I found that there are some brethren who I think have more concern, and it does scare me, they have more concern for animal life than human life. There was a lady in the congregation where I preached, and when I showed a picture of a starving dog, Gasps went across the auditorium. I mean, you could see this dog's ribs, every single one of them. The dog had been horribly mistreated. And the book of Proverbs does teach about not mistreating animal life just for the sake of our pleasure or sport. There's nothing in the Bible that would authorize that. But I got to thinking to myself, this woman ended up leaving the church, she said, because I showed that picture of a starving dog, and that was just too cruel for the children to have to endure. And I'm thinking to myself, here we have children that are being tortured, slaughtered, and people are more concerned. You know what? Michael Vick should have become an abortionist. That's what he should have done. Now, I don't mean that I mean that very much, believe me, with tongue in cheek. I'm not suggesting that what Michael Vick did to dogs, to animals, was not barbaric and inhumane. I believe very much that it was. But you know what? If he had become an abortionist, would there have been an outcry such as there was for what he did to animal life? There are people every day in this country doing even more barbaric. Notice, I still said what he did was barbaric. But there are people in this country doing even more barbaric things every day with the approval of the law of the United States of America. They're slaughtering innocent human life in ways that are far more barbaric and torturous than you can imagine, and we've got to wake up.
I think one other issue, and it's been hinted at and touched on briefly, and it's along the lines of what Tyler just spoke concerning, we're not saying that all life has the right to continue to live, but the question is, who is it that has control over life? And who is it that has the right to answer the question, who should live and who should not live? And man has taken upon himself that right, use that term loosely, I guess, that he does not deserve. It belongs to God. God's the one that puts the sanctity in life. He's the one that defines it. He's the one that has shown us that life is in the blood. He's the one that told us when we conduct ourselves in certain ways that we deserve to lose our lives, whether it be murder or, in the cases of the Old Testament, homosexuality and other transgressions. But the idea that he holds the germ in his hand as we sing, at times, he's the one who controls life, and we should leave it that way. But God's the one that controls it. He's the one that has sanctified it and set it apart, and we don't have the right to take upon ourselves that which is reserved and left only for Jehovah and only for God. Do you want me to introduce this?
Yeah.
We've got another question that has been asked. Still on the theme of Jeremiah, but not necessarily on the last lesson, but the question is, please discuss the relationship of Jeremiah 20 and verse 9, the fire in his bones, or in my bones, to 1 Thessalonians 5:19, to quench not the spirit, and 1 Corinthians 14:26 through 30, and that would be in a context where Jehovah is regulating the use of the miraculous gifts, 1 Corinthians 14. Basically, does the Holy Spirit, who inspires the prophets and writers, in any way force action by men, example, to prophesy or to preach, is any of the Spirit's work involuntary for man? And as we would go along in this area, I would emphasize that it is man who puts himself in a position to be used by Jehovah. And he can choose to do so. And in the times when men were inspired, they could present themselves as fit tools for Jehovah to do his service. When Jeremiah said, I could not withhold, it was not a matter of possibility, but more a matter of determination. In Galatians chapter 5, for example, the Spirit wars against the flesh, and the flesh wars against the Spirit. So that you cannot do the things that you would. Doesn't mean that it's impossible, but you determine that you will not do it. And all of us do that. I've used the example before. My wife's here. She's heard it 100 times if she's heard it once. I can't eat boiled cabbage and liver. I just can't do it. and someone says, well, you know, how do you know? Well, I've tried it. I mean, I could physically eat it. Wouldn't be pretty. But I have made the determination that that's just something I'm not going to do. I don't like the taste. I don't like the smell. If you're having that and you invite me to dinner, don't get upset if I get up and go to McDonald's, because I can't do it. I'm not going to. That's the determination. In 1 Corinthians 14, in that very same context, in verse 32, it says, and the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. And so that things might be done decently and in order, Paul wrote to these men who were inspired by the Holy Spirit, these men who may have had the gift of prophesying, and said that they are the ones that control that. And the very fact that Paul warns against quenching the Spirit would indicate that man can do that, and it would be his choice. I'm convinced the emphasis is that we ought to follow the Spirit's direction, that revelation, whether it's given by inspiration as it was in the first century, or as it is given today in the written word, that we need to follow it, and we don't need to do anything that would hinder it. We don't need to do anything that would alter the message or change the message in any way. BJ?
During the break, before the question and answer session began, another question arose that I think would be good to comment on briefly, and my good brothers here may as well. First of all, I'm completely bumfuzzled. I didn't know anybody could eat liver and boiled cabbage. Or McDonald's either. I don't know. But, the question arose, we have a nurse here who works in oncology and dealing with terminal patients. And when we talk about ending the life of the terminally ill, the Dr. Kevorkian, you know, a physician-assisted suicide mentality. Here again, because of time, we can't go into depth on all these issues, and so we didn't get into a detailed discussion of euthanasia and the ethical dilemmas and difficult controversies that arise in connection with end-of-life issues. But please let me emphasize at least this much, that we're not suggesting that you're under moral obligation, if you are terminally ill, to take any extreme form of treatment that might extend your life. It's not a disregard for the sanctity of life and for your own life to refuse some radical treatment that might itself be painful and might have little promise of extending your life. We're talking about taking of life of the terminally ill, the active taking of life, active euthanasia, where you say, well, you're terminally ill, and so you don't want to go through a long, painful, prolonged illness, so we'll just administer a lethal dose of a morphine and kill you. That's what we're talking about. And when the patient desires it, that's voluntary active euthanasia. Or when the patient simply refuses nourishment, or we refuse to give nourishment, that's a passive form of euthanasia. But what is a concern as well is the movement from voluntary euthanasia to involuntary euthanasia, where someone else then is going to decide that we're going to either remove basic care. We're not talking about radical treatment, but we're talking about basic fundamental care like food and water. We're gonna remove that from you, or we're going to administer a lethal dose of medication. We're going to refuse needed medical treatment based on the decision of some ethical board or committee or hospital protocol or whatever the case might be. That's the sort of thing we're talking about. And we're not saying that you have to be kept alive on a ventilator if you're whole brain dead. But that's different from being only having cerebral death or higher brain death, where you're in a persistent vegetative state And then saying, well, we're just going to remove food and water from you. So we're trying to make those careful distinctions, and we don't want to leave the impression that, you know, that the terminally ill are under obligation to just keep on taking whatever treatment they can. We're talking about the sorts of scenarios we've described here. And so, once again, it is an issue where you really have to thoughtfully analyze on a case-by-case basis. I've had members of the church, maybe you have too, have come to me, well, can we pull the plug on my husband, my grandmother, my mother? And there are cases where, in my view, clearly you can, where a person is whole brain dead. And we're not saying you have to keep pumping air into essentially a dead person, virtually. So we have to make those kinds of distinctions. We're simply trying to cry out, though, against the culture of death that is saying that those who are, like Terry Schiavo, inconvenient to us may be disposed of based upon the will of another.
There was a passage that used to trouble me a bit and wasn't really quite sure of the best way to explain it. And years ago at our lectureship in Southaven, Brother Danny Box, who was a gospel preacher and also worked in the medical field, made allusion to this text, and it kind of clarified some things for me. Maybe it will be helpful today to just take a brief notice of it. It's in Proverbs 31, and you'll recall that at first he's discussing the fact in verse number 4 that it's not for kings, O Lemuel, it's not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. But then he says this, give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish, and wine unto those that be of heavy hearts. And the idea is expressed in this text that a narcotic could be given to one who is ready to perish, who is in the process of dying for the purpose of deadening their pain. It is not in any way, shape, or form an advocation of the drinking of alcohol socially, in any way, shape, or form, any more than we would argue that one could shoot morphine into their veins socially. That's something reserved for those critical moments when death is fast approaching and the pain is greatly severe. And so they didn't have the same kinds of sophisticated drugs that you and I possess today that are available to us, but they did have the deadening effect of certain narcotic agents available to them. And on this occasion, what he's pointing out is those kinds of things are only for the purpose of helping people in the midst of their greatest pain as they're dying, as they're ready to perish. They're not for the purpose of drinking as a social beverage or anything of the sort. I know that all of us up here today would say that this can be a thorny issue sometimes as far as when to make decisions about pulling support from someone. And how many of you have heard recently about this former football player that was pronounced dead and then was, I forget the details, do you remember exactly? If you Google, a number of these Googles become a verb in our culture, has it not? But you can look up a number of these cases where someone that was thought to be comatose and beyond the hope of any repair at all as far as certain things were able to come out of it. It's happened on numerous occasions. That's not to suggest that those who are, as he said, whole brain dead are falling into that category, but we have to be cautious about these decisions, prayerful about them for sure, but we need to be mindful of the fact that we don't know all that God knows about certain issues, and it's not really within the parameters of our knowledge and ability and wisdom to start making decisions that fall into the category of Terry Schiavo and saying basically, well, you know, we don't think she could ever do any better than this, and therefore we're going to go ahead and pull the plug. No, that wasn't what happened to her, was it? She was starved to death. It wasn't a simple matter of pulling the plug.
Have at it. If you have a question, what's the time? Roughly?
17 minutes.
Left or into it? Okay. We finish this up, and if you still have a question, feel free to come forward and sit here, and I'll see that you have one, and I can stop or hurry and finish and get your question in. Before I sort of wrap up some of this material I had planned to present, I might deal with one other question quickly, and that is, when we talk about Roe versus Wade, you'll hear a lot of alarmism in the media over any appointment of judges who would possibly rule in favor of overturning Roe. And the cry that you'll hear is that this particular politician or this particular judge wants to ban abortion, wants to outlaw abortion. But the myth perpetuated by the media, among others, concerning Roe, is that that overturning Roe would make all abortions illegal. It would not. It would simply leave it to the individual states to decide whether they will make it illegal or not. Now, surely some states would try to outlaw it, and some surely would not. But all overturning Roe would do was put the issue where it ought to be, and that is directly in the hands of the people in the individual states. But those who promote abortion don't want that. They don't want the people to decide. They want to impose their will on the people, and they can't do that through the democratic process. So what they cannot accomplish democratically, they have to impose by judicial fiat, by using the courts. And you see the problem there then, where a small vocal minority has been able to impose its radical secular agenda on the rest of the country against its will. The other myth perpetuated about Roe is that Roe only allows abortion in the early stages of pregnancy, and that is something the media has misled the public on since the 1970s until this very hour. The fact is, Roe allows the killing of an unborn child right up till the moment before birth, right up through the ninth month and into the final stages of pregnancy. Now, not all states allow that, but Roe permits the states to do that. And so we are the only Western culture that provides virtually no protection at the federal level for unborn children in the womb. This is important, I think, for us to understand that these issues of life and death that we're facing in our culture ultimately hinge on our understanding of human nature. Who are we? And our understanding of ourselves is determined by or inextricably related to our view of origins, our worldview, how we think about ourselves and morality in the world is tied to our view of origins. And that establishes our ethics. That's what determines how we value human life. Our cosmogony, our view of the origin of things, affects or determines our anthropology, our view of man. And that shapes our ethics, and that determines who lives and dies. And the biblical understanding of man as the unique creation of God is what forms the basis for the sanctity of life view. And that sanctity of life view is described by Robert George this way: the profound, inherent, and equal dignity of every human being, which demands that all human beings should be respected and protected, irrespective of not only race, sex, ethnicity, but also of age, listen to this, size, location, stage of development, and condition of dependency. Well, that's the implication of Genesis 1, where we're told about our beginnings, that God created man in his own image. And that's what gives you your intrinsic value. Your value is absolute because of your nature. It's not relative. It's not subjective. It's not contingent upon something else. But it's inherent because we are made as the offspring of God. That's why Genesis 9:6 says that taking innocent human life without just cause is a crime of such magnitude that one forfeits his own right to live. That text says, whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Why? This is critical. Mark this in your Bibles. For in the image of God he made man. That's why innocent life must be protected, because it is in the image of God. And that view that is known as anthropocentrism, that man has this unique status, that he occupies a privileged place superior to other forms of life, because unlike other forms of life here on earth, we are made in the image of God. But Singer and others ridicule that as speciesism, like racism. You think your race is superior to other races? That's racism. If you think your species is superior to other species, that's speciesism. Notice how Singer connects his subjective view of the value of human life with rejecting creation. And this is powerful. He says that the philosophical foundations of the sanctity of life view have been knocked asunder. We can no longer base our ethics on the idea that human beings are a special form of creation made in the image of God, singled out from all other animals, and alone possessing an immortal soul. Our better understanding of our own nature, he means evolution, Darwinism, has bridged the gulf that was once thought to lie between ourselves and other species. So why should we believe that the mere fact that a being is a member of the species Homo sapiens endows its life with some unique, almost infinite value? You see that? It's critical we understand the culture of death is the result of exchanging the truth for the lie, the truth about our divine origins, for the materialistic, Darwinistic view of man. So this whole debate over our origins has such far-reaching implications. Because that secular, that evolutionary understanding of man inevitably leads to this frightening ideology expressed by Singer there, that you don't have any inherent right to life just because you're Homo sapiens. And that's what allows us to dispose of unwanted life with impunity. It's only in the biblical truth that we are the offspring of God, made by His hand, in His image, for His glory, that we find the only valid absolute grounds for valuing and protecting innocent life. And overthrowing that biblical worldview, brethren, is the path to Hitler's ovens. If man is mere matter, we can express it this way, then he doesn't matter. And that's what we're seeing. But this whole culture of death, finally, is really a form of modern idolatry. I want us to tie this back to Jeremiah. What was Jeremiah dealing with? Judah had apostatized into idolatry. And the culture of death we're seeing today is itself a form of idolatry. The Supreme Court in the Casey decision, which upheld Roe, said, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. So here they're suggesting, you know, at the heart of liberty is your right to define your existence any way you please. To live as you please. Paul Kurtz, the humanist, said, if man is a product of evolution, one species among others in a universe without purpose, then man's option is to live for himself. That's what's behind the culture of death. Max Halkett said, evolutionist said, the fundamental question of ethics is, who makes the rules, God or men? The theistic answer is that God makes them. The humanistic answer is that men make them. Well, which men do you want making the rules? I believe BJ and Don have suggested that this all hinges on God as the author of life says who lives and dies. Man want to assume that prerogative over life themselves, to be their own gods. The disregard for life in our time is a result of abandoning the knowledge of God. Listen to this. Paul said they exchanged the truth of God for a lie when he talked about the Gentile idolaters of old. They worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator. They did not like to retain God in their knowledge. So God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. And what were those things? When they didn't like to be limited by God, and God gave them over, among the things listed, murder. And he says they were without natural affection. And that translates a Greek term which means this: lack of feelings of natural tenderness as seen in a mother who exposes or kills her child. That was a practice in the ancient world. If you wanted a boy and you had a girl, they just leave it out, let it die of exposure. Well, Paul said that sort of disregard for life stems from those who don't want to have God in their knowledge. Do you see that when we trace back the destruction of life in our time to its ideological roots, we find that it's all about throwing off the yoke of God's commands to be free in our pursuit of pleasure. Brethren, it is idolatry, the worship of self. And in this whole current debate over who we are and why or whether we matter, it's imperative for the church to articulate a biblical apologetic on the origin and the value of human life. Like Jeremiah, like the prophets did, we need to call for repentance, for a return to God. That is the only way back from the culture of death that threatens us all. If we have any more questions, we can take them, or if you guys want to add anything or close. Boy, if you give me more time, I'll use it, huh? No. You've been very patient. I know that was a lot of material, and I'm glad I had a little extra time to get it in, but I didn't mean to limit any questions that we might have had or any comments that BJ or Don would like to make.